It has been, for many of us, a tumultuous week. Pope Francis's encyclical that included a monumental challenge on climate change, asserting that there is very solid scientific evidence now of disturbing warming of the climatic system, and the announcement by Republican buffoon Donald Trump that he is entering the presidential race. That provides us with the humor for the week, I think. But probably most importantly, the terrible tragedy at Mother Emanuel AME Church in South Carolina. And sometimes I think, what's a preacher to do with all of this material out there? And I confess to being greatly conflicted about my original plan, shaped weeks ago, really, to preach about a concern that has long been on my mind and in my heart, namely the seemingly endless conflict in the Middle East, particularly as it relates to Israel. It was Jack Topchick's excellent opinion article in the Frederick Post a number of weeks ago that moved me to choose this topic. In the meantime, I have been part of a very, very serious study group taking a hard look at Ari Shavit's book entitled My Promised Land. It is an excellent history of the triumph and the tragedy of Israel, and I heartily recommend it to you. It's a long book, but it is packed, and the narrative at points is almost poetic. It is beautiful, beautiful first-person writing. And as late as Friday evening, I considered shifting gears rather dramatically and scrapping my idea altogether and dealing rather with the issue of race and of gun violence in our land. But then I got to thinking that in peculiar and, I think, profound ways, these topics are somehow closely related. Each has a backdrop of terrible violence and horror. Each tells a story filled with the stench of death, as well as unbelievable courage and heroism. Each is overlaid with religious as well as secular ideologies, plural, and that's important to remember, plural, some of which are filled with love and inclusiveness and forgiveness and vision and all of those wonderful things, and others filled with hatred and bigotry and unspeakable tragic violence. So first, a word about Charleston. We continue as a society, I think, to not want to look very systematically at the ideologies, the systems and the ideologies that permeate a culture that is highly charged with racism. And so what happened in Charleston is too often blamed largely on an individual whom we want to believe is mentally and emotionally deranged, and who, in a fit of racist rage, kills 9 people in a church. And yet the truth of the matter is that a Confederate flag still flies over the State House in the Capitol, a symbol for many, many people, I don't know how many millions, of a war that still goes on. It flies in a religious culture of fundamentalist evangelicals whose theology, and theology is important to talk about here, is about saving individual souls rather than being concerned with earthly racial injustice. Indeed, to be concerned about justice, rather than personal sin is viewed as unbiblical and tantamount to a sin itself. Jeb Bush, a not very good Roman Catholic now running for the presidency, echoes this thinking. Religion is about making us better as individuals, as he pats his heart. It's certainly not about politics. It's not about changing the world. It is, as some have called it, a religious theological defense system that can easily reject a prophetic message of a Martin Luther King, say, or the thrust for racial equality of a black congregation like Mother Emmanuel. It is a theology that in its worst moments can embrace white supremacy and quite literally dehumanize people of a different race or creed or ethnicity. To be sure, much of the religious establishment has tried to grow up, even fundamentalists. And many now reject the idea that racial inferiority is part of God's design for creation, whatever that may mean. Yet that theological defense system that was part of segregation and Jim Crow and going way back, the atrocities of slavery, those symbols linger on. And those symbols of the past, like a flag, or making voting rights more difficult, or a legal system that consistently oppresses minorities, all bump up against and are always on the very edge of racial bigotry and hatred. And it is well past time that politicians and religious leaders are challenged when they use this lingering defense system as an excuse. States' rights is another one. The Dylan Roofs of this country feed upon those excuses, and we are myopic if we do not realize that. Roof's license plate and the flags on his jacket tell us volumes about his hatred and the problem of our culture. Israel is a very far away place, and yet it is very close indeed. And the conflicts there are as old as biblical times and as new as yesterday. Both Carl Gregg and I, because of our theological training, are biblical scholars of a sort. And although that scholarship may help us interpret the present in light of the past, deep insights are few and far between. And I confess to being puzzled. I confess to not having many answers, if any. And I think Carl would probably say the same. The religious tensions between ultra-Orthodox Jews going across the spectrum to Jewish liberals, that tension has always been there, and it has always been great. Throw into the present mix the secularists, and it gets complicated even more. And all of this, and we haven't even talked about the Arabs yet. So it is a complicated scene. Ari Shavit's book examines the complexities and the contradictions that is Israel. How did it come to be, or why? Will it survive? Good question. Shavit's story begins with his great grandfather, Herbert Bentwich, in 1897. He's a citizen of Great Britain. And he is motivated, unlike some other people, but he is motivated by his faith to become part of what will soon become the Zionist movement founded by Theodore Herzl. Zionism, just a little bit of definition here. Zionism is that broad term used for the effort to establish a political Jewish state. Herzl is interested in colonizing Palestine, and he wants Bentwich to spy out the land. Good biblical concept, if ever there was one. So Shavit writes, there was need for a revolution. If it was to survive, the Jewish people had to be transformed from a people of the diaspora to a people of sovereignty. In this sense, the Zionism that emerges in 1897 is a stroke of genius. Its founders are both prophetic and heroic. The 19th century was a golden age of what in Western Europe, Jewry. Yet the Zionists see what is coming, or at least they sense what is coming. True, they don't know about Auschwitz or Treblinka yet, but in their own way, they act in the 1890s in order to preempt the 1940s. They realize they are faced with a radical problem, the coming extinction of the Jews. So the scene is set for the colonization of Palestine under British rule at this point. But there is a major problem that some see and others do not see, really. They see, but they don't see. Shavit wonders why his great-grandfather was one of those who did not see. For the land to be colonized was already populated by many Bedouin nomads. And they are largely poor and humble, with no property rights. Shavit speaks poignantly about his grandfather not really seeing, in the sense of understanding, what that meant to an already present people. It is a powerful metaphor, and I invite you to keep it in your mind's eye for a moment. It is a metaphor that is of not seeing, that stretches even into this present time, except now the circumstances are vastly different. Look, if you will, at all of the Jewish settlements all over the land. And the argument, which was put forth by a colleague of Shavit's just a couple of weeks ago in the Post, that no one should be bothered about the settlements, even though they have been ruled illegal. Who cares, he says. Well, who cares, of course, are present-day Arabs, who are not so invisible anymore, and who see the internationally outlawed settlements as an effort now to drive them out of the land and to obliterate them as a people. The metaphor then gets played out in terrible and violent ways on both sides. But we get too far ahead of our story, for between 1897 and 2015, much has happened, and I wish I had an hour or so to relate all of that, but I don't. Carl wants me to keep this under 1,000 words or so. No, he didn't say that. But much has happened, and much of it is almost unbelievably good, and much of it is tragic down to the bones. There are the kibbutz experiments in cooperative living. Shavit says, love affairs flourish, babies are born. What a tender line. But then the Arab herdsmen come and the horsemen terrify the kibbutz girls. There is conflict. Orange groves are planted. Have you ever eaten a Jaffa orange? Jaffa? You know that name? Orange groves are planted and commerce begins in earnest. And the plenty is shared for a while, Arab and Jew working side by side. But by 1935, Germany has chosen Nazism, and ominous clouds are on the horizon. The need for a Jewish home becomes self-evident. Now it is the case that any reasonable person can see that Europe is becoming a death trap for Jews. And it is also true that America will not open its gates in time to save the persecuted Jews of Europe. And as that influx of Jews from Europe increases, tensions between Jews and Arabs escalates. There are Arab attacks on Jewish civilians, but also atrocities committed by fringe group Jews, inflicting even greater damage. And then, of course, skipping so much history, the big war comes, the Holocaust. And the large Jewish populations of Europe, of Russia, Poland, Germany especially, are decimated. And finally, in late 1945, the nightmare of the planet seems over. But at what cost? Never again. Never again. 1948 sees the end of British colonialism in Israel, and it is established officially as a state, and war breaks out almost immediately between Arab and Jew. Israel is victorious, whatever that means, but with a few notable exceptions, there have been few periods of what one might call real peace. Attempts occur occasionally, Camp David, the Oslo Accords, but the cycle of violence continues. And yet, in the midst of it all, the accomplishments are astounding. For Israel has taken in now literally millions of Jews from nearly 57 different countries. It has accommodated a tremendously diverse population of immigrants, many of them poor, many poorly educated, some very religious, many secular. What it has taken the United States several hundred years to accomplish, rather poorly, I would say, in many respects, Israel has done in less than 70 years. In the 1960s, there was what was called euphemistically the project. It is the Dimona decade when Israel secretly built the bomb, with a little help from the French, of course. And it is clear, parenthetically, that one of the reasons Israel is so exercised about Iran's capability to build the bomb is the belief that inspections won't really work. Israel knows about that because U.S. inspectors inspected the building of the bomb in Israel and didn't discover it. Israel knows how to deceive very effectively. And now, the beat goes on. The various factions in Israel have one thing in common. They all want to survive. And how to do that with ideologies that conflict with one another seems an almost impossible task. The Middle East is fraught with conflict, and Israel is surrounded, as it has always been surrounded, by largely hostile powers. It lives in fear, with an overwhelming paranoia that few of us can comprehend, I think. Jack has talked about this with me a little bit, but I know that paranoia. It is deep. It is deep writ in the whole culture. There is this little piece of real estate that is so strategic, it seems, to everyone, And so, as my theologian brother Dominic Crossan says, here is a people who live in a land that gets beat up over and over and over and over and over and over again. And you can keep repeating that almost ad infinitum. All of the way from biblical times to the present. And so you can understand the paranoia. Are we going to be beat up yet one more time? But it is different now in 2015. And here is a linkage, I think, between what is happening in our country with race relations, or the lack thereof, the divisions and the hatred, and the ideologies that lead to violence, which we can no longer afford to live with. So too, Arab and Jew cannot afford to live in conflict in a nuclear powder keg, because I suspect Iran will get the bomb. They know how to do it. And other countries will get the bomb. Ideologies that are filled with hate and vengeance need to be allowed because we believe in free speech. But we need not tolerate them as normative, nor do we need to excuse them, nor do we need to finance them to the tune of billions of dollars. There has got to be a different paradigm. Shavit is somewhat pessimistic about the future of Israel. Many people are skeptical, including myself. A two-state solution seems more and more untenable and unlikely, partly because if you look at a map of all of the settlements, it's like Swiss cheese on a map. And Israeli leadership really doesn't want a two-state solution. And Arab leadership is divided and doesn't think it is possible. So where might we go? I'm not sure where we might go. We need to go someplace. What might be some of the parameters if we have anything to say about it at all? I think there are some clues. They are all around. There is history. There is tradition. Think of Fiddler on the Roof. Tradition, tradition. Part of that history and tradition is essentially the same for Israel and much of our very troubled society. It is rooted in the prophets of old and in the whole notion of a promised land that is metaphor of a condition of life that is liberation, which is something to be shared generously rather than hoarded. The promised land is a symbol of hope for people who have been oppressed and in that proverbial exile of slavery. And Isaiah calls it light to the nations. What a shift in paradigm, light to the nations. Would that it could be so. The irony is that at one point, a very high point, it happened in a very significant way for just a short period of time. It is the story that Shavit tells of Dr. Siegfried Lehmann. He was a Berlin doctor, and he started a community in the Valley of Lida. The village, says Shavit, fulfilled that rather utopian value of its founder. So I close now with kind of a challenge. coming out of this passage, which I think is maybe one of the most beautiful passages in Shavit's book. Quote, he realized that the life of the Jewish people had become unbearable. He acknowledged that the displacement and detachment they experienced threatened Jews physically, mentally, and spiritually. But Lehman believed that in the 20th century, displacement and detachment were not solely a Jewish malady. He saw that a sense of rootlessness was also threatening contemporary Western civilization. He wanted Zionism to suggest a cure both for the modern Jewish people and for modern man. He wanted to fulfill an urgent national task in a manner that would benefit all of humanity. He wanted Zionism to be a settlement movement that was not tainted by colonialism, a national movement that was not scarred by chauvinism, a progressive movement that was not distorted by urban alienation. He believed that Zionism must not establish a closed-off, condescending colony in Palestine that ignored its surrounding and native neighbors. Zionism must plant Jews in their ancient homeland in an organic fashion. It must respect the Orient and become a bridge between East and West. Zionism should be a salvation project, giving home to the homeless, providing roots to the uprooted, and restoring meaning to life. So may it be.